A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about a trip he hasn't taken yet. He moved from Ireland to Israel 10 years ago, and all his dream destinations are in East Asia. China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan. Not for the temples or the street food, though I'm sure that'd be a bonus. He wants to go somewhere that challenges his worldview rather than somewhere designed to be comfortable for tourists. Japan especially appeals, because it seems to embrace eccentricity and strangeness in a way the West doesn't. But here's the thing he's actually poking at. It's one thing to say you want your norms challenged. It's quite another to actually have them challenged. So his question is, for a Westerner who's never been, what are the fundamental cultural gaps you'd need to understand before you go? Not guidebook etiquette. The deep assumptions about work, family, strangers, the state. The stuff that quietly trips you up because you didn't even know they were assumptions. And then he adds a wrinkle. He's been watching documentaries about daily struggles in China, and a lot of it connects with life in Israel. Housing costs, pressure, the grind. Which made him wonder whether the gaps are actually where the cultural commentary says they are, or whether day-to-day life is more shared than we think, and the real differences sit somewhere else entirely. So we're going to dig into what actually trips you up, and whether the map of differences we carry is even the right one.
The Noah Smith piece from a few months back makes exactly this argument, and I think it's the right lens for what Daniel's asking. His point was that the East-West cultural gaps people obsess over collectivism versus individualism, hierarchy versus egalitarianism, those aren't necessarily where the friction lives. The day-to-day stuff, the economic pressures, the housing anxiety, the sense of grinding through your 30s wondering if you'll ever feel stable. That's surprisingly shared across Shanghai and Tel Aviv and Dublin. What differs isn't the struggle. It's the script you're supposed to use while you endure it.
The script. That's a useful word for it. The invisible instructions about what you're allowed to say out loud while the same thing is happening to you.
And if you don't know the script exists, you walk into a room and start improvising from your own cultural playbook, and people aren't rude to you. That's the dangerous part. They just quietly conclude you don't know how to behave. Nobody tells you you've broken a rule because telling you'd itself break another rule.
So Daniel's actually signing up for two things. One is the disorientation of being somewhere genuinely unfamiliar. The other is the much weirder experience of discovering that half your personality is just local custom. Stuff you thought was you turns out to be Irish.
Or Israeli, at this point. He's been there a decade. He's got layers.
Right. So let's start with the most mundane arena where these scripts show up, because it's also the one where the gap is widest and most consequential. Work.
The thing about work in East Asia, and I'm going to speak mainly about Japan and China here because they're the ones Daniel named, but this applies across the region in different degrees, is that work isn't a transaction. It's not hours for money. It's identity. It's where you belong. And that's not a metaphor. The Japanese salaryman system, which dominated the post-war economy and still shapes expectations even as it erodes, was built on lifetime employment. You joined a company after university. You stayed there until retirement. Your social world, your drinking buddies, your sense of purpose, all of it flowed through the firm.
And that's not ancient history. The system's fraying, but the expectation that work is the center of gravity hasn't gone anywhere.
No, and the extreme endpoint tells you everything. Japan records hundreds of recognized Karoshi cases every year, death by overwork, stroke, heart attack, suicide triggered by brutal hours. And those are just the cases the Labor Ministry officially recognizes. The real number is certainly much higher. The point isn't the tragedy, though it's tragic. The point is that this isn't a bug in the system. It's the logical endpoint of a culture where presence and effort are moral goods, not just inputs to productivity.
The morality of showing up. That's what trips up a Westerner. You can know intellectually that leaving at 6 p.m. when your boss is still at his desk is frowned upon, but you don't feel it in your bones the way someone who grew up in that system does. You think you're being efficient. They think you're being disloyal.
Right. And the mechanism is presenteeism over productivity. A Japanese office at 9 p.m. isn't necessarily producing more than a German office that shut down at 5. But the act of staying communicates something. It says, I'm committed. I'm part of this group. My individual time is less important than my visible solidarity.
China's version of this is the 996 culture. 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. It's notorious in the tech sector, but it's not just tech, and the framing is different from Japan's. Where Japan's overwork is rooted in loyalty to the firm, China's is often framed as sacrifice for national progress. The individual burning out is contributing to something larger than the company, the country's rise, the century of humiliation being avenged through sheer effort.
And then there's the phenomenon of Naijuan, involution. It's a term that exploded among young Chinese workers in the last few years. The idea is that everyone is competing harder and harder for a fixed pool of resources, and the competition itself becomes exhausting without actually producing more. You study harder to get into a good university, so everyone studies harder, so the bar rises, and now you're all studying until midnight, and nobody's odds have improved. It's a generational complaint that sounds a lot like Western burnout discourse, but the political valence is different. In the West, burnout is often framed as a failure of self-care. In China, it's a structural critique with edges that make the state uncomfortable.
Which is why the term itself became politically sensitive.
Yes. The government didn't ban it outright, but there was a clear signal that too much involution talk was unwelcome. Because if young people are saying the system is a trap, that's a different problem than saying they need better time management.
So Daniel's watching documentaries about young Chinese workers grinding through housing costs and pressure, and he's thinking, this looks like Israel. And he's not wrong about the surface similarity. The pressure to buy an apartment by your late 20s or early 30s, the sense that you're running on a treadmill that someone else keeps speeding up, that's real in both places.
But the script is different. In Israel, the cultural narrative around the grind is that it's absurd and you complain about it loudly, preferably over coffee with 5 friends who are all complaining too. The complaint itself is a bonding ritual. In Japan, complaining about work to colleagues would be a failure of the group. You don't burden others with your dissatisfaction. In China, you might complain privately to close friends. But the public posture is different. There's a pragmatism, a sense that this is the deal and you knew it when you signed up.
So the experience is similar, but the permission to name it varies enormously. And if you're a Westerner walking into a Japanese workplace, and you start doing the Israeli thing, airing grievances, treating complaint as social glue, you've just marked yourself as someone who doesn't understand how groups work here.
And nobody will tell you. That's the part that keeps me up. You'll just notice, over time, that people are slightly more formal with you, slightly more distant, nothing you can point to, nothing anyone would confirm if you asked.
The quiet tripwire. That's what Daniel's trying to map before he walks into the room.
Let me give you a concrete example of how deep this goes. In Japanese schools, there's a concept called kuki wo yomu, reading the air. It's not just a social nicety, it's literally taught. Children are trained to sense the mood of a room, to understand what's being communicated without words, and to adjust their behavior accordingly. By the time someone reaches adulthood, this is second nature. A Japanese colleague doesn't need to be told that the boss is displeased. They feel it. The air in the room has changed.
And the Westerner is standing in the same room, same air, feeling nothing.
Feeling nothing. And probably saying something that makes it worse, because they misread silence as neutrality instead of as a very loud signal.
So that's work. But work bleeds into everything else, because if work is identity, then the boundary between professional and personal isn't where we think it is. The deep gaps show up in how you relate to strangers, to yourself, to the whole idea of what a self even is.
Let's start with the stranger relationship, because it's where the Japan-China contrast is sharpest and most illuminating. In Japan, the default toward strangers is polite distance, not coldness. It's a deep respect for boundaries. You don't impose on others. You don't make eye contact on the subway. You keep your voice down. The public sphere is a shared space that works because everyone agrees to be minimally intrusive.
Which sounds lovely until you realize... It also means nobody will help you if you look lost, because offering unsolicited help would be an intrusion.
That's exactly the trade-off. And it's not that Japanese people are unkind. If you ask for help directly, people will often go far out of their way to assist you. But the initiative has to come from you. The default is non-interference.
China's different.
China's different. The default can be much more direct. Queuing norms are looser. Personal space is smaller. Someone might comment on your appearance or your salary or your marital status in a way that would feel invasive to a Westerner or outright shocking to a Japanese person. But, and this is the crucial distinction, this directness operates within strong in-group, out-group boundaries. The warmth and bluntness you get as a guest or a friend isn't the same thing you get as a stranger. And navigating where you stand in that boundary at any given moment is its own skill.
So Japan's challenge is the polite opacity. China's challenge is the directness that might feel like warmth, but comes with complex social calculus underneath.
And both of them will mess with a Westerner's head, just in opposite directions.
Now, this is where Daniel's Japan question gets really interesting. He said Japan appeals to him because it seems to embrace eccentricity and strangeness in a way the West doesn't. And he's not wrong. You can find things in Tokyo that would never exist in Dublin or Tel Aviv. Maid cafes, robot restaurants, entire subcultures built around obsessions so specific they barely have names in English.
The Harajuku fashion scene alone is a walking argument that Japan is one of the weirdest, most creatively unhinged places on Earth. And yet, the same culture that also produces the salaryman who wears the same dark suit every day for 40 years and would rather die than stand out at a meeting.
This is the paradox Daniel needs to understand before he goes. The West sees eccentricity and assumes it means the culture is permissive. That weirdness is tolerated everywhere. Japan's trick is that eccentricity is compartmentalized. It has zones, times, contexts. You can be the most flamboyant visual key musician on stage, and then put on a neutral expression and disappear into the crowd on the train home, and nobody thinks this is contradictory.
Because it's not contradictory in the Japanese model of selfhood. The Western assumption is that authenticity means expressing your inner self consistently across all contexts. If you're wild at heart, you should look wild at the office, at the grocery store, at your grandmother's funeral. Anything else is hypocrisy. Japan assumes the opposite. Context dictates behavior. You have a work self, a family self, a hobby self, a public self. They can be radically different, and that's not inauthentic. That's being a properly socialized adult who understands that different situations call for different selves.
This is the thing that quietly breaks Westerners. The small moment where you realize the Japanese friend who's been warm and funny and open with you in private is a completely different person. The moment a third party enters the room. And they're not being fake. They're being appropriate. And your entire framework for judging character doesn't have a category for that.
The deepest version of this I've ever encountered. Noah Smith wrote about this, and I think it's the single most useful concept for Daniel to carry with him, is the distinction between the public self and the private self. In the West, we've collapsed those. We think authenticity requires making the private self public. In Japan, the private self is private for a reason. It's not hidden out of shame, it's protected. The things that matter most to you, your true preferences, your doubts, your eccentric passions, those live in a sphere that isn't for public consumption.
Which means you can visit Japan for 3 weeks, have wonderful interactions, and never once see anyone's actual private self. And you might not even notice you haven't seen it.
And you'll come home and say the Japanese are polite but reserved, and you'll have missed the entire point. The reserve isn't a failure of connection. It's a different map of where connection belongs.
Let's talk about the state, because this is another place where the scripts diverge sharply and Westerners keep tripping over their own assumptions. The Western relationship to government, especially the American version, but it's seeped everywhere, is suspicion. The state is a necessary evil at best. You don't trust it. You assume it's incompetent or corrupt or both. Skepticism toward authority is a sign of intelligence.
Japan inverts this. The default relationship to bureaucracy and authority is trust. Not naive trust. There's plenty of cynicism about politicians. But a deep assumption that systems work, that rules exist for good reasons, and that following them is sensible rather than sheep-like. You see it in the smallest things. People wait at crosswalks when there are no cars coming. They don't jaywalk. Not because they're afraid of punishment, because the rule is the rule and the rule makes the shared space function.
And this extends to how the state interacts with citizens during crises, the compliance during the pandemic, the orderly evacuation during earthquakes. This isn't authoritarianism. It's a social contract where the state is assumed to be competent, and citizens are assumed to be cooperative, and both sides mostly hold up their end.
China's relationship to the state is different again. It's more pragmatic. There's less trust in the Western sense and more acceptance that the state is powerful and you navigate around it rather than against it. The Chinese internet is full of people finding creative workarounds for regulations, bending rules without breaking them, treating the state as a weather system you adapt to rather than a partner you cooperate with. It's a survival skill refined over generations.
And the Westerner shows up with their default skepticism and starts making jokes about the government, which in Japan just reads as boorish, and in China reads as unwise.
Different kind of unwise in each place, but yes, in Japan, you violated the norm of not making others uncomfortable. In China, you've potentially created a genuine problem for the person you're talking to, who now has to decide whether to laugh politely or distance themselves.
Let's come back to Daniel's deeper question. He's been watching those documentaries about daily life in China and feeling this strange recognition. The housing costs, the pressure, the sense of grinding through your 20s and 30s. And he's wondering whether the gaps are actually where the cultural commentary says they are.
I think the answer is yes and no, and the Noah Smith framing gets this exactly right. The material struggles are shared. A 28-year-old in Shanghai trying to afford an apartment, a 28-year-old in Tel Aviv trying to afford an apartment, a 28-year-old in Dublin trying to afford an apartment. They're living versions of the same problem. Housing crises are global. Economic pressure on young people is global. The anxiety about whether you'll ever be as secure as your parents were is global.
What's not global is the narrative you're supposed to wrap around that anxiety. In the West, the narrative is individual. I made bad choices. I should have picked a different career. I should have saved more. The failure is personal. In China, the narrative has been collectivist. This is the price of national rise. But that's cracking. And the involution discourse is exactly young people starting to say, no, this isn't sacrifice. This is a structural trap. And we didn't build it.
In Japan, the narrative is quieter. The pressure is internalized. You don't complain about the system because the system is an extension of the group, and complaining about the group is complaining about yourself. So the same economic squeeze produces different emotional textures in different places. Same pain, different language for describing the pain.
If you're Daniel, walking into one of these places for the first time, you'll recognize the pain faster than you'll recognize the language. That's the trap. You'll think, oh, they're just like us. This is universal. And you'll be half right. But the half you're wrong about is where all the misunderstandings live.
The other thing the Noah piece points out, and I think it's crucial, is that a lot of what gets labeled as deep cultural difference is actually just different stages of economic development, or different policy choices, or different historical moments. The reason Japanese offices still use fax machines isn't some ineffable cultural preference for analog technology. It's bureaucratic inertia and a regulatory environment that favored fax documents for legal reasons. The reason Chinese cities feel chaotic to a Westerner isn't Confucian philosophy. It's rapid urbanization at a scale and speed the West never experienced.
Some of the gaps Daniel thinks he needs to prepare for aren't actually gaps. They're just different local equilibria. And some of the gaps he'd never think to look for are the ones that'll actually trip him.
The real gaps aren't about values. Everyone broadly wants security, dignity, connection, meaning. The gaps are about the scripts for pursuing those things. And the scripts are invisible until you violate one.
Before we wrap, Hilbert has been sitting on something for the last 20 minutes.
I spent 2 years in Japan in the 90s, teaching English in a town you've never heard of in Gifu Prefecture. I lived in a company dormitory. My roommate was a salaryman named Tanaka who worked for a textile firm. 14-hour days, sometimes 16. He'd come home at 11 p.m., sit on his futon, stare at the wall for about 10 minutes, then go brush his teeth. Did this 5 or 6 days a week for the entire 2 years I was there.
Did he ever talk about it?
Never complained. I kept waiting for it. Some crack. Some moment where he'd say something human about how exhausted he was. Never came.
What did you talk about?
Weather. Baseball. What I'd eaten that day? He was perfectly friendly. Just, the work wasn't available for discussion.
because complaining would have been a failure of the group.
That's what I thought. Took me about a year to figure out the other half of it.
Which was?
He had a locked cabinet in his half of the room. One night, I came back late, and he'd fallen asleep with it open, full of vinyl. American Jazz, Coltrane, Miles, Monk, original pressing, some of them. Maybe 60, 70 records. He'd never mentioned music. I'd been living 6 feet from this guy for a year, and I had no idea.
He kept it completely separate.
That was the point. The jazz wasn't for the office, it wasn't for the dormitory, it wasn't for me, it was his. The secrecy was the whole thing.
That's the compartmentalization you were describing, but applied to a single human being. His authentic self existed only in a locked cabinet that nobody else was supposed to see.
I never told him I saw it. Would have ruined it.
That's the thing. The Western instinct would be to say, how sad, he couldn't be himself. But that's imposing our framework. For him, being himself meant having something that was nobody else's business.
I've still got a Mingus record I bought at a shop in Nagoya because of him. Never listened to Mingus before that.
Did you ever talk to him about it after?
No. He moved out 6 months later, transferred to the Osaka office. Wrote me a postcard once. Said he hoped I was enjoying Japan. Didn't mention the records.
The deepest cultural lesson you brought back was something you were never supposed to see.
That's about right.
Where does that leave Daniel? Staring at the map of differences he's trying to draw before he ever buys a plane ticket.
I think it leaves him with a better question than the one he started with. The original question was, what are the gaps, so I can prepare for them? The better question might be, what am I carrying that I think is universal, but is actually just? Irish, or Israeli, or Western, or me?
Because the gaps aren't a fixed set of facts you can memorize. They're the moments where your script and someone else's script collide, and you don't even know a collision happened until you're already walking away, wondering why the conversation felt wrong.
Some of the most important things you'll never see at all. They're in a locked cabinet. They're in the silence after a 14-hour day. They're in the air that everyone else in the room is reading, and you're standing there breathing normally.
The misconception people carry into this, and I think it's the one Daniel is actively trying to avoid, is that cultural gaps are about values. That East Asians are collectivist, and Westerners are individualist. And if you just memorize that grid, you'll be fine. The real gaps are about the scripts, the invisible instructions for how to pursue things everyone wants. Security. Dignity. A life that means something. The goals are shared. The routes are different. And you don't see the route you're on until someone else takes a different one.
The jazz records are the image I'm going to be stuck on. The idea that the most authentic part of a person might be the part they protect by hiding it. That's not a failure of openness. It's a different theory of what a self is and where it belongs.
If Daniel goes to Japan, or China, or Singapore, the thing he'll actually learn isn't a list of cultural differences. It's that half of what he thought was his personality is just the script he grew up with. That's the challenge he's signing up for. Learning about himself by discovering which parts don't translate.
We should thank Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the Mingus record he apparently still owns.
This has been my Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own question, about travel, culture, or anything else that's been quietly bothering you, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.